difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to the Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Keith Phipps, here with
Tosh Robinson
and Genevieve Kosky.
Scott Tobias is not here this week. Scott, we miss you.
We really do.
Yeah. Here on the Next Picture Show, we believe that no film exists in a vacuum and that all culture is more interesting in context. So every other week, we get together to talk over a classic film and consider how it relates to a current movie. This week, we're looking at two movies focusing on The Batman, the billionaire playboy slash masked Avenger who's been a fixture of pop culture since its first appearance in the pages of Detective Comics back in 1939. Tasha, what can you tell us about this week's pairing?
For this week's episode, we watched Batman, Tim Burton's 1989 film, which brought the superhero to the big screen for the first time since 1966, when he appeared in a quickly made feature film tied to the phenomenally popular Adam West starring TV series, a campy show that had defined the character for the general public for decades. In some respects, Burton's film was a reaction against that series, using grimness to push back against the series' lightness and humor. 28 years later, we've been through what Batman scholar and friend of the podcast Glenn Weldon has described as cycles of dark to light and back again. And with a Lego Batman movie appearing just a year after the supremely dour Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice, we currently seem to be living in a moment where those cycles have started to coexist.
So, which is the real Batman? The pitiless persecutor of criminal scum, or the punning adventurer? Or are we asking the wrong question? For our answers, we'll consider where Batman came from and where he's going. But first, let's look at Batman as he appeared at one particular moment in time, June of 1989.
I'm Batman.
Where did he get those wonderful toys?
My life is really complex.
Winged freak terrorizes. Wait till they get a load of me.
The internet didn't invent outrage, it just sped it up. Just ask Tim Burton and Michael Keaton, who had to cut through a thicket of skepticism on their way to making Batman. Burton was an animator turned director making his third feature, a follow-up to the funny, inventive comedies Pee-wee's Big Adventure and Beetlejuice. Keaton was an actor best known for comedies like Mr. Mom and Night Shift. According to a 1989 article in Empire magazine, that's a British film magazine, Batman fans, who were already skeptical about Burton's involvement, inundated Warner Brothers with, quote, 50,000 letters of protest complaining that Keaton had no chin and not enough hair. He was too glib, too scrawny, simply not the right man for the job. This is notable for a couple reasons. One, people used to write letters to movie studios. And two, by the late 80s, fans of Batman had a definite idea of what the hero should be, and he definitely should not be funny. The years before Burton's Batman had seen the release of grim, acclaimed books like Frank Miller's The Dark Knight Returns and Alan Moore and Brian Bolland's The Killing Joke. Both of those arrived on the heels of over a decade of stories that took Batman seriously in the years after the Adam West Batman left the air. In short, fans had an idea of what kind of Batman they wanted and what they didn't want, and despite his background, Burton gave them that Batman. But he went further. Working with production designer Anton Furst, Burton summoned up a Gotham City out of some alternate universe where Art Deco took a really dark turn. Drawing from a script by Sam Hamm and Warren Scarron, he and Keaton delivered a Batman who was nearly as messed up on the inside as Jack Nicholson's Joker. And despite some scenes that look more visible now than ever, it worked. Batman established a tone of high stakes, high seriousness for superhero films that became a model for others to follow and alter, for good and ill. So what's it like to pay a return visit to Burton's Gotham, so many superhero movies, and so many Batman later? We'll discuss after the break.
What is all this?
The police have got it wrong. They're looking for one product. The Joker has tainted hundreds of chemicals at the source.
Then all shipments of products would be poisoned. And we'd all be dead.
No. The poison only works when the components are mixed. Hairspray won't do it alone, but hairspray mixed with lipstick and perfume will be toxic and untraceable.
How did you figure this out?
Take that to the press.
I might have some trouble with that. A lot of people think you're as dangerous as the Joker.
He's psychotic.
Some people say the same thing about you.
What people?
Well, I mean, let's face it. You're not exactly normal, are you?
So, guys, my wife shared an alarming report with me. And one of her coworkers had recently shown this film to his kids who grew up on superhero movies from MCU and so on, modern superhero movies. And they found it old-fashioned. I'm on record on hating the term dated a lot, but maybe it's at least worth talking about how it fits into the history of superhero movies. How did this look to you? What are we, 27 years later? 28 years later?
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Almost 28 years later.
Let's just say 30. 30 years later, how did this look to you?
It looked really, really heavily influenced to me by Richard Donner's 1978 Superman,
mm-hmm.
just in terms of the emotional content, particularly the romance, which this movie really had me wondering, why do so many Batman films focus on the romance? Like, it's the least interesting, like, who he's boffing at any given moment, who he's feeling soft feelings for is like the least interesting part of any Batman story. And this movie goes so hard in that direction to the point where Alfred is practically pimping him out. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's incredible how hard Alfred is pushing for these two to get together based on a conversation and like a night in the sack. And it's creepy, honestly. It's weird.
There's all this dialogue about her being a really special person. And, like, you know, I like Kim Basinger in this movie just fine, but there's nothing really sets her up as a very special person.
Yeah. She has to do a lot of surprised screaming in this role.
Oh, I hated the screaming so much. I mean, she screams every time something looks at her. And there's a point midway through where I was like, I should go back and track how often she screams.
Yeah.
And then, like, 5 minutes later, I was like, I don't have enough fingers. It's just too much.
Yeah, her character is this, like, weird cross between, like, a dame and a damsel, I guess. Just going back to, you asked how did it look for you on a return visit? Most of it looked really good. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the thing that we probably all agree on is that the production design of this, it's still great to go back to all these years later. But it did also look to me more like a comic book in that it was much more static than superhero movies are today. Batman moves so slow in this movie.
Yeah.
Like, he's more of a stalking Batman than anything, you know. And superhero movies today are just so influenced by action, and they're fast, and the fighting is fast, and this is not that, you know. There's lots of kind of really nice tableaus where you see Batman kind of like lowering in the background, but there's not a lot of like exciting fighting, which is such a central part of most superhero movies today, the more recent Batman films included.
Well, it feels like part of that is that I noticed this in the first confrontation where he's, you know, taking down the two pickpockets or muggers or whatever you want to call them. We actually see what he's doing, and it looks ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it looks like a human being in a rubber suit, like doing silly things with a string. And I feel like more modern, like Batman movies in particular, just kind of turn him into like a blur of motion.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when he drops down, you don't see him. When he pops up out of somewhere or disappears somewhere, you don't see him. When he's fighting, it's just kind of, as you say, a blur of motion. Because the more you see of it, the more aware you are that this is a thing that's kind of ridiculous mm-hmm. in the real world. But here it's like, here it's all on screen, mm-hmm. and you have to confront like what it actually looks like.
Yeah.
I think some of those are limitations of the suit, frankly. Mm-hmm. I mean, just there's only so much you could – the suit technology has advanced since then.
You got to have the baton wings mm-hmm. out, you know, whenever he jumps, that impractical cape. But there's a shot where a goon – I'll just call him a goon.
They're all
like, yeah. He jumps toward Batman, who is facing away from him, and plunges through the floor behind mm-hmm. Batman, like a foot behind Batman. The floor collapses, and then Batman just stays standing on the floor. And like that in particular struck me as like a panel out of a comic book. Like, I could see that being illustrated, you know. But in action, it just looks so silly. It's like, wait, why didn't Batman go through the floor? Like, why is he standing on the support?
I think they ruined that a little bit because Batman then turns around and looks.
Yeah.
Whereas if Batman is just so smart, he knows exactly where to stand on the floor.
Right. Yeah.
Which, you know, that's, you know, that makes sense for Batman. That's, I think that's a better gag, I guess. But yeah, not a lot of great action in some ways. But the car is cool though, right? I mean, all the other.
You mean the Matmobile?
You know, there was as I was watching this film, I kept thinking, I'm having a hard time connecting this with Burton's previous movies. Like, mm-hmm. visually, emotionally, conceptually, I'm not entirely sure I'm there. And then we got the Batmobile shields, and I was like, okay, there's Tim Burton.
Yeah.
Like, there's his specific processes and his style of animation that we're seeing his experience here on screen.
I think it's the most Burton-y when it's focusing on Bruce Wayne, which I think is one of the stronger elements of this film, is Michael Keaton's interpretation. Bruce Wayne is kind of a messed up outsider who's all been really damaged on the inside. And you know, he kind of fakes his way through the world as Bruce Wayne. And he's really is this kind of dark creature of the night. That's who he is on the inside as well. I think that's really strongly set up in the first half of the movie. Like, watching this movie, and we'll get into this a little bit more later, but I felt like the first half sets up a much stronger, like, you know, these sweeping themes of darkness and light, and the characterization of Wayne is really interesting. And the it all kind of plays out in these grand operatic sets. And I don't really care if the action's a little static. I think as a big costume drama of a different kind, I think it works really well. And that movie I really like, and it kind of loses me toward the end. I don't know if that was your experience as well.
No, I hate Keaton Batman.
Really?
Yeah, oh, wow. And one of the reasons I hate Keaton Batman.
No.
He has such a weak chin.
His chin does not necessarily bother me. What bothers me is, and again, I think this is the Superman influence. In Richard Donner's Superman, Christopher Reeve plays Superman as this sort of, he's like weirdly detached from it all because he's an alien. Mm-hmm. And he kind of walks around with this like look of ecstatic confusion on his face. That's just like, I'm surrounded by alien creatures and they're all so soft and fragile. And then he meets up with Margot Kidder and it's like, let's go for a fly and like stare longingly at each other because we're so confused because we don't, what could possibly be happening? This is new for both of us.
Can you read my mind?
I could sing about it, which is practically as good. And we get the same thing here with Keaton. When he's first introduced, I mean, he looks like somebody just pole-axed him. Mm. And it's supposed to be because he's seeing Vicki Vale, who's beautiful. But then he talks to other people and he still looks pole-axed. He sits at the bat computer and he still looks pole-axed. He walks through this most of this film until he confronts the Joker in Vicki Vale's apartment. He just seems the entire time like he's walking around just like, what just happened? And I think that that's an interesting idea for Bruce Wayne. It's just this idea that he's not this like brutally controlled individual who knows who he is and what he wants and is driven like Lego Batman only by rage and no other emotions. But he seems so gormless in a way that makes him not even harmless to me, just kind of dopey.
I think it's kind of, all right. I think in some ways it's kind of unfair to compare the casting there because Christopher Reeve was basically born to play Superman.
That's true.
I mean, he is, maybe it's a generational thing, but come on, Christopher Reeve is Superman.
I have no problem with that. And I have no problem with the characterization. And I think it's a really interesting choice for Bruce Wayne. Mm-hmm. But the combination, I think everything that you're saying about trying to set up this contrast of like really messed up inside, trying to find himself, not really sure who he is or who he wants, which side of himself he wants to be. Mm-hmm. I think that's all really interesting. I don't think Keaton pulls it off.
Yeah, it works for me. I actually really like Keaton's performance.
I think I fall in the middle of you two because I generally like him as Batman, despite mm-hmm. what I was saying about like Batman being so sluggish. Like I think that's the film, not Keaton. But yeah, I'm not a big fan of his Bruce Wayne. I agree that it's interesting, but there's a gormless was a really good word for it, Tasha, so I'm just going to steal it. But there's none of the suaveness I associate with Bruce Wayne or the self-assurance, which, you know, if we are viewing this as a story of like Bruce Wayne slash Batman figuring out who he is, that makes sense. I just don't know that I enjoyed watching it that much.
Hmm. Well, I definitely don't think Bruce Wayne would sit in the Batcave in a turtleneck and jeans.
No.
I think this is very, very
and little
poor
Steve
Jobs
glasses.
Yeah.
He anticipated Steve Jobs' entire look.
That's true.
Okay, so here's a question. Do you think Batman would go to his current love interest because Alfred told him to and stumble for 5 minutes over the words, "I'm Batman"?
No. That's a bad scene. that's when I talk about the seams showing. This is a movie that was, you know, being rewritten throughout the whole process. Sam Hamm wrote apparently 5 drafts And then the similarly rhyming Warren Scorin was brought in. And there was another screenwriter, too. And there was a writer's strike, which I'm not sure how that played into it. But
from what I've read, Sam Hamm basically just had to recuse himself completely after five drafts. And they brought in like a string of people to rewrite it.
Yeah. And that scene was I believe it was kind of worked out on the set. I think Glenn in his book, which plug Glenn Weldon's book, The Cape Crusade, Batman and the Rise of Nerd Culture.
Which is Keith is holding up to the mic. Yes, you can see it through the camera.
But no, it's a very good book. It's a great history of Batman written in a very fun conversational style. It makes an interesting argument around some of the same questions we're asking tonight, which is what do we want from our Batman? But anyway, that scene seems like largely worked out in the set. Glenn describes it as an actor's exercise, which is what it plays like. And that's rough. I found the whole second half of this movie kind of rough for a couple of reasons. The finale is, I think, fairly disastrous. Like
my balloons.
I don't mind the balloons.
I actually love that line reading from Jack Nicholson. Yeah, it's a silly scheme that he has.
Why are they climbing up the tower? It's kind of like a King Kong thing.
And a Vertigo thing.
And very much a Vertigo thing. Yeah, very much a Vertigo thing. But to what end, though? It doesn't make a lot of sense. And I like Batman, guys. And I have some I think you can bend Batman in a lot of different directions and he's still Batman. But Batman doesn't send the Batmobile in to blow up a bunch of bad guys, especially in a movie that's established that he does not kill bad guys. Like he goes to great pains to show him using non-lethal weapons.
I mean, when he throws that guy down the Vertigo Tower, he pretty much kills that dude.
After a certain point, a wholly different Batman kind of comes in.
And wasn't it pretty controversial at the time that the Batmobile had guns on it?
Yeah, Batman
Like the Batwing also. Like as soon as it started like unfurling machine guns and he started shooting missiles into a crowd, I was just like, who is this Batman?
Yeah, so what's the story there? Like it seems like an odd thing to add to the character, and not necessarily a Burton-y thing to add.
No,
so,
I'm not sure what story is there, but yeah, I feel like there are after certain points you're not making a Batman movie anymore, and that's one of them when he's actually killing the bad guys.
Yeah. There's also just that strange confrontation where he's flying the Batwing directly at the Joker, and the Joker's just standing his ground with machine gun bullets like tearing up the ground in front of him and like pulling out his comically immense gun. Like that gun is a hilarious reveal, but it's out of a Warner Brothers cartoon.
Right.
Like it's a Looney Tunes moment, and it's especially a Looney Tunes moment when he shoots the Roger Rabbit gun and like shoots a plane out of the sky.
I'll follow comic book logic in two different things here. Batman is such a good shot. He doesn't mean to hit the Joker. He's just trying to manipulate him. And the Joker is such a criminal mastermind that he can come up with that kind of gun. I'll go that far with that movie.
The whole thing,
I don't want to nitpick.
As like a completely isolated moment. It's a Batman cartoon moment. It could be a Batman the Animated Series moment. It would be something that would play as part of this film in conjunction with some of the other things that happen. It feels weird and out of place. But I never fail to laugh when he pulls out that gun. He keeps pulling out that gun until it's all out.
We should talk about Nicholson's Joker.
I was going to say we have to talk about the Joker because like we're talking about an aspect of his character that like we don't really see in more modern interpretations of the Joker, which is the clown aspect. Like this interpretation leans really hard into the clown. Like he has the boutonniere and the joy buzzer and the extendable boxing glove, you know.
In his balloons.
Yeah, in his balloons.
Balloon animals.
yeah, exactly. So it's strange that we're getting this sort of like darker interpretation of Batman and this connection between Batman and the Joker, a sort of like twisted yin-yang. But then there's this clown kind of interpretation grafted on top of it that allows for these slapsticky moments that feel at odds with that interpretation and with modern interpretations of both characters.
It works for me. I find it, it's a scary clown, you know? It's slapstick without any kind of limitations where like people are going to get hurt from this violence, you know? And I think Nicholson's a lot of fun. I think kind of like Christopher Reeve, where you had the perfect Superman, you have this great, amazing performance by Heath Ledger as the Joker years later. So, you know, just Nicholson doing Nicholson, and I think it's a lot of fun.
Wasn't Nicholson, though, considered pretty definitive before Heath Ledger came around?
Yeah. I think there's a lot of notes of Nicholson's performance and what Ledger does too in some interesting ways.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure like Ledger talked to Nicholson when he was preparing for the role.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a lot of feeling at the time, like when the movie was being cast, there was a lot of pressure for Nicholson. There was a lot of feeling that like only he could possibly do this movie, which is interesting because when Heath Ledger was being cast as the Joker, people were like, oh, the gay cowboy, like he's going to be terrible. Mm-hmm. There was so much backlash against him on the web.
He was the Michael Keaton of Dark Knight.
Exactly. Yeah, there was a lot of protest against it, and it panned out. But I mean, I enjoy Nicholson in this role. I think that he does a really interesting job, and the script does a really interesting job of bringing across that Jack Napier was always like a sociopath and a psychopath and like a terrible human being, but with a sort of innate canniness. And I think that they handle the Joker transformation, not only the literal one where he pulls off the bandages, sees himself and just kind of like loses it like into the clown moment, but also the transformation of that kind of practical psychopath side into the completely impractical psychopath who's willing to embrace what he's physically become by turning it into a persona. I think that's a really interesting aspect of this film.
Yeah, I do too. I do like the sort of Jack being dangerous. They establish that really nicely early on. I do not like the circular origin story at all, which was a thing that Sam Hamm did not want to end the movie and Burton did. And when Hamm was gone, it got back into the movie.
But it's weird. I like exactly half of it. I like the moment where Batman says, you know, you made me first, and Joker just flips because that is not part of his script. And Nicholson pulls that moment off so well. That's childish. Why are you saying that? But yeah, having Jack Napier be the one who killed his parents is – it's just one of those lazy, there are only three characters in the world kind of script folds.
Right.
Where it just – you know, you're shrinking the world down to a really pointless level when you do that.
You killed my parents.
What?
Huh.
What are you talking about?
I made you. You made me first.
Hey, bad brain. I mean, I was a kid when I killed your parents. I mean, I say I made you. You gotta say you made me. How childish can you get, huh?
You wouldn't hit a guy with glasses on, would you? Huh?
So I'm gonna look to the Batman scholar in the room, or relative Batman scholar, and ask, is the Joker-Batman connection dichotomy thing, had that been previously established in comics?
I think it's unique to this.
It is, okay.
The whole Joker killing Batman's parents thing, yeah, that's...
But also just the idea that Batman can't exist without the Joker, and the Joker can't exist without the Batman.
I think that's a theme they've been playing with for a lot of different writers have played with. I'm not a scholar enough to point you in the
I don't know.
Hold Glenn's book up to the mic. Yeah. See if it has anything to say.
I don't know how far back that goes, but I mean, I'm sure that I was aware of it, like as of The Killing Joke. Mm-hmm. It was very clear that, you know, Batman had inadvertently created him and he was obsessed with Batman.
I think that's really the most explicit depiction of it.
But there's also, I mean, in Dark Knight Returns, where the Joker's been comatose for decades, I think.
Right.
And it's not until Batman comes back that he wakes up, and it's very clear that so much of his like emotional life is tied to Batman that he literally does not exist in a world where Batman doesn't exist either.
Sure.
And he comes back within seconds of realizing that Batman is out there again, which is also something that Lego Batman plays with in a fun way, but we'll get to that.
Mm-hmm. So this was a film that cemented Burton as a director of big budget blockbusters. For all the turmoil that went into making it, and the cost that went into making it, it was a huge hit. Made a lot of money. Kind of touched on it a little bit before, but how do you see this fitting into his career? Like what's coming, what came before, and what came after?
I mean, the Michael Keaton connection to this is a very early example of Tim Burton's, I have worked with an actor and now I'm obsessed with that actor.
Sure.
And I'm going to just take that actor to the next movie. You know, he found Johnny Depp and Helena Bonham Carter, and then he rode them like ponies for decades. But in this case, it feels like he brought Michael Keaton along from Beetlejuice into a role that is very different and maybe not as suitable. But if you look at Beetlejuice, you kind of see the Joker. You know, you see another case of this like anarchic, crazy character who does what he wants and lives in this like strange, clownish, emotional universe and is very playful sometimes and very menacing sometimes and attaches onto people emotionally and plays with them for fun.
It's chaotic above all.
Yeah. I feel like it actually took seeing this Batman for me to feel like I understood where Beetlejuice was coming from as a character. You know, because I saw that movie fairly young and I was like, is he a good guy or a bad guy? I don't understand. Because he wasn't like any character I'd seen before. And then I saw Jack Nicholson's Joker and I was like, okay, that's a character I've seen before.
And it does feel kind of like a natural segue into Edward Scissorhands, which came the following year, at least kind of in terms of the isolated loner, I guess.
Misfit
is a good word for it. So it definitely slots in very naturally between Beetlejuice and Edward Scissorhands in that way. As far as Batman Returns, I haven't seen that in years and years. I seem to recall liking it more than Batman, but
I think it's even more Burton-y and less Batman-y in some ways. It's more like this strange fetishistic portrayal of messed up people who find each other in the romance between Batman and Catwoman. And Penguin is like turned into like this monster.
Yeah, Penguin is super grotesque.
Yeah.
You know, like I remember kind of having nightmares about Penguin as a kid. You know, like to me, Penguin is actually a scarier rogue because of that movie than the Joker ever was, because that was like that was the kind of the definitive Batman villain to me for so long.
Yeah,
he's got the world's most soulful parents, though. His parents put him in a basket like Moses and float him down the river because they have to get rid of him. And it's Paul Rubens and Diane Salinger just playing this like sad little soulful moment of we have to give away our strange penguin child.
That does feel kind of Burton-y too, though.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, he got a lot more creative license with the second one, and I'm not sure it was a hit, but not as profitable, and that's why he's not around for the third one. But it feels like he had kind of a good thing going there for a while, where Batman and then Edward Scissorhands, which is very much a Tim Burton movie, Batman Returns, Nightmare Before Christmas, Ed Wood. It's very unusual director to settle into such a nice groove in Hollywood, but he made it work for a while. And I guess, you know, your mileage may vary, but maybe he still is.
I thought he didn't want to be on the franchise after Batman Returns. My reading on that is pretty old, I think. But
I think it was a mutual parting of ways. Yeah. I don't think Warner Brothers was not very happy with the excesses of it in some ways. So I think they wanted a more family-friendly and toyetic Batman for the next one.
Yeah, that is not necessarily a toyetic film.
Enter Joel Schumacher.
whose name means toyetic. Joel Schumacher is, I guess, a natural person to pick those up in that he's always been kind of a workman for hire with like a really good eye for striking like weirdo images, especially at the time. But like Burton just had so much of a stronger sensibility, I suppose. In some ways, for me, this movie still feels like a weird anomaly in Tim Burton's career, you know, because he is so much into this idea of the wacky outsider who is sometimes very dangerous and is sometimes just like charmingly morbid and strange and eerie and misunderstood. But the kind of the pattern of the story that he likes to tell doesn't map all that well over like established Batman canon or established Batman character. And at the time, people were so excited because we were back to a dark Batman and a definitive Batman. But it kind of seems like they almost immediately said, yeah, but this also isn't like the Frank Miller Batman that we're super into right now. And very quickly, it just kind of became like the beginning of the dark bat canon, like a kind of a ground level that we were going to keep working our way into darker and darker dark territory from.
Yeah, I think it is and it isn't an anomaly, because if you look at his more recent output, Burton is a lot of like sort of attaching himself to Tim Burton friendly existing properties. Mm-hmm. Planet of the Apes, but especially things that have like sort of a
Alice in Wonderland,
things that have a kind of like
Peregrine,
things that have kind of like a Hot Topic appeal, you know, yeah. Where it's like for the budding suburban goth, these are your favorite movies. I don't mean that as completely as a slag. I like some of those movies. I actually liked Miss Peregrine. I know Tasha and I were talking a little bit before about she said she liked it a lot less than I did.
I hated it would not be too strong.
Yeah, but I hate Alice in Wonderland with a passion of
that's fair. I hated that first movie and I never saw the second one.
Well, that wasn't him, but I never saw the second one either. But so let's talk Batman. Let's talk Batman. Where does this rank for you on the scale of Batman's interpretation that you enjoy?
Keaton specifically, or the film?
I think this film, the Burton Batman in general. Yeah. We'll do the other two. I like them, but I think they've been superseded in some ways.
Yeah, I'll admit I have not revisited most Batman films. I do think the Christopher Nolan films like loom much larger in my mind. Obviously, they're more recent, but which is kind of weird to say because I feel like my tastes don't usually align with like the grimmer and grittier version. I usually tend to go for the more whimsical.
Sure.
And I think of the between Burton and Nolan versions, Burton is on the more whimsical side. But this film just feels like a more uncomfortable fit between those two sides, whereas the Nolan film just kind of like goes all in on the darkness. And I guess it works better for me. But like I said, I haven't revisited any of these films other than for this.
I have to admit to having a real sentimental attachment to this movie, too. I was 16 when it came out, and this is kind of like, I don't even know if this happens anymore, but this movie kind of loomed over the entire summer. You know, it was just, you know, Batman T-shirts everywhere. It was sort of there's a song I believe called "Bat Dance" by an artist named Prince that got played on the radio a lot. It was a summer of Batman, so I am fond of this one. I'm not sure my favorite interpretation of Batman would happen without it, which is Batman the Animated Series.
Batman the Animated Series. I thought we were just sticking to the movies.
No, I'm just talking in general. But it owes a lot. I don't think it would exist without this, but I think it builds on this in some really interesting ways.
Yeah. I'm switching my vote to Batman the Animated Series because I used to watch that after school every day.
That's so good.
And I'm going to go on to, you know, stuff like Justice League Unlimited and Young Justice and some of the comics that came after this. Like, for me, the definitive Batman has never been a film Batman. I feel so much like committee think around any version of Batman on film. And the Dark Knight films are better in terms of trying to be darker without like wallowing in the, okay, by the end they're wallowing, but the first one at least like feels like it's trying to get to something serious and interesting about the Batman mythos. But there's always this sense of posturing and working really hard for the metaphor for me in Batman films, whereas stuff like the animated series can just so purely be about story. Mm-hmm. The Batman the Animated Series, like some of the scripts are still amazing. They still hold up. They're still really good Batman stories. The way he would kind of flit in and out of Young Justice, the cartoon series, like I loved that version of him. He's a lot more free in the animated series to not have a cheap romantic angle that's tacked on, to not have to have a clean start to finish arc, and to be the Batman that is interesting to me, who is maintaining what he does over a long period of time, as opposed to having to be part of this start to finish arc that they keep cramming into the movies.
Yeah, I guess we can talk wider range of Batman interpretations in the next half too. But yeah, I like Dark Knight Rises more than a lot of people, but the whole end of it kind of makes it less of a Batman movie in some ways to me.
Here's a question. Is Batman interesting, or is it his rogues that make him interesting?
He does have one of the best rogues galleries. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that's undebated. But for me, Batman is the most interesting superhero. Just
why?
The most interesting. Because of that conflict. Because when you're talking about a Batman story, you're almost inevitably talking about the story of a man who is probably in his 30s or 40s, who is defined by something who happened to him when he was 9 years old. And he created himself around that moment. And to really be Batman, he doesn't change. And it's a tragedy that he doesn't change, but it's also fascinating. He's fascinating because he doesn't have superpowers in a world that is packed with the heroes and villains, many of which he has to fight, who do have superpowers. He is defined by the fact that he's smarter than everybody else. He like thinks more deeply than everybody else. He does the Sherlock Holmes research that gives him the information that makes him function in a world where he can't just like pick up a car and huck it at somebody. I mean, he's kind of aspirational in that he is just a human. He's just managed to make himself the best human. That makes him really ripe for like a lot of humor and a lot of over the top kind of stuff, and sometimes for like really ridiculous and painful interpretations. But what I like about him is that he is so complicated in terms of that striking the balance between how tormented is he versus is he just somebody who knows who he is and is happy with it. Depending on who's writing him, he can be very, very different and still be the same character, still be consistent.
Yeah, I think even without the bad guys we know, a lot of what Tasha just said, the sort of person who choices were made for him early in his life and that shaped who he is, but he's kind of fought against that by becoming the best person he can possibly be, and yet still kind of defined by being an unhappy character. Mm-hmm. All that makes for a really compelling character, even if without a rogues gallery. And I even think, simplifying it a little bit, like the Batman who's just out there solving crimes like a detective or patrolling the streets and protecting people, that's compelling in its own way as well. Not that I would want to get rid of the rogues gallery, but I think you can write a good Batman story without any of the rogues if you had to.
Okay, well, you guys have sold me on Batman as a concept, I guess. But going back to Batman, the film that we are discussing, do we get that smartest guy in the room detective thing from this version of Batman?
Gormless.
He looks really intense when he's wearing that turtleneck.
it feels like Vicky does a lot of the kind of the heavy lifting here.
Yeah. I mean, he's clearly done some, like when he's giving her the file to take to the newspaper about what's dangerous, he's got like all of these mouthwashes and hairsprays sitting in front of him. And he's clearly done the chemical testing and figured out what the combinations are. It's just that's science, and this movie thinks science is boring and is more interested in fantasy, so we leave all of that off screen. But like, he's clearly done his detective work.
But it's literally in the background.
It is literally in the background, and it looks.
You're gonna get a montage. A detective montage would be a lot of fun.
Just him puzzling over a bottle of scope.
Which Prince song would we set that to?
That would probably be a more organic way to work a Prince song into this than they are in the film. That's another compromise we should talk about is Prince, which was sort of foisted on the film, and Burton was not a fan of having to incorporate Prince music. But when you're Warner Brothers and he's your biggest artist and this is your biggest movie, you want some synergy. What do you think about Prince music in here?
I mean, Prince wears purple, the Joker wears purple. It all falls together.
I don't like it. I don't like it at all. Like, it's the art gallery boombox thing. It almost feels like an FU to introduce it that way in this setting where it so clearly doesn't belong as a way for the Joker to mess with people or upset people.
Sure.
You know, like it feels almost pointed to use Prince in that context based on what we know about Burton's feelings about including it. Yeah, I mean, obviously it's Prince. The music is good, but it just does not fit the tone or the setting of this movie at all. Like I think it really positions this movie, I won't say it dates this movie, but it positions it in time in a way that I think does not necessarily benefit it on modern viewings.
It's tough. I think Burton read an interview with him later where he said, I probably would enjoy this album on its own.
Right, exactly.
But, yeah, and it's not Prince's best album, but it's not a bad Prince album. Yeah. It was kind of, in some ways, my way into Prince because I bought this album and started working through the Bat catalog. Mm-hmm.
You mean the Bat catalog?
The Bat catalog, yes.
Boo.
That too.
So you guys already have kind of like dismissed the balloons sequence, but I mean, I actually kind of like that.
I don't mind the balloons sequence. I just feel like it's part of a weaker part of the film, but that's really nicely staged.
That whole parade where Trust is playing and he's setting up that crowd by throwing money and gathering in all these people who he's immediately going to poison. Like, I can see not feeling that like jibes with the tone of the movie, but I liked that sequence because it actually seemed like something the Joker would do to me. And on top of all that, it feels like something the Heath Ledger Joker would do because it's this bizarre capitalist moment of, you know, you idiots will do anything for money, including at the end where he's just poisoned a whole bunch of people. Now, Batman's been shooting up the crowd and there are still people climbing all over his foot trying to get at the money.
Yeah.
And there's just that feeling there that, you know, people are idiots, and it really, like, what the Joker does and what Batman does, there's kind of a push-pull there that's like, is everybody in the city going to die from being dumb, or is Batman going to rescue them all from themselves?
The Prince definitely works better there. And I will say the balloons, which again, I just really like that line reading, is the reason I brought it up. But the design of those balloons, that's Burton. Like, you see, you really see Burton in that parade and just the design and construction of that parade.
What's your favorite? I like the big baby.
Yeah, the creepy baby, for sure.
It is a very unsettling baby. But, I mean, to me, the music works there.
Yeah.
Final thoughts? Maybe, Tasha, maybe you have a favorite character we haven't gotten to yet.
I don't know if he's a favorite character, but I am repeatedly tickled by the presence of Tracy Walter as Bob the Goon. It's so out of character for the Joker to have this like second in command who's completely loyal to him, who's just kind of standing by with whatever he needs right until the moment when he gets ticked off. But and there's just something so bizarre about like I'm a crazy clown with a ton of makeup slathered on my face, singing and dancing. Here's this like unshaven Skid Row bum hanging out next to me, handing me things. Tracy Walter is fun in this movie.
I'll just say that the Joker rictus grin remains unsettling and scary, and that is some really good makeup, and the way it is kind of utilized across the film and on characters, mostly dead characters other than Joker, is effective.
The newscaster scene is really great. And that's very Burton-y too, especially when the later scene where they have no makeup on.
That is a completely unremarked upon joke that is terrific.
Yep. Yeah, that's the thing. This movie, I mean, we've certainly pointed out a flaw or two, but it's a movie I could watch right now. You know, I find it very entertaining and much to recommend it, and despite some problems.
And it's, you know, egregious abandonment of, it's egregious abandonment. The series egregious abandonment of Billy Dee Williams,
yes,
who really deserves better.
But
and he gets his due in Lego Batman.
The Lego Batman movie, which we'll get to in part two. So let's wind this up for now, and we'll be right back with some listener feedback on our last episode. In our last episode, we looked at two movies that, in the words of our absent co-host Scott Tobias, bookended the Clinton era, The War Room and Wiener. One topic we raised regarding Wiener was that it began as one sort of documentary and became something else. Then we kind of froze in a moment when we tried to think of other examples, but happily some of our listeners picked up our slack. Genevieve, can you share one example?
Certainly. Timothy writes, "When you put out the call asking for documentaries that became something else when they were being filmed, I immediately went to 2013's Mistaken for Strangers. Starring the New York indie rock band The National, lead singer Matt Berninger invites his brother Tom, who's 9 years his junior, on the tour. Tom, who is a budding horror movie, quote, filmmaker, brings his camera with him and starts capturing the on-tour experience. As you watch the film, you see all the typical rock doc tropes, band members being interviewed, backstage antics, and concert footage. What the film actually becomes is a look at Tom and Matt's relationship, Tom's struggle to make something of himself and to step out from his older brother's shadow." I haven't seen this film, but I believe you have, Keith.
Yeah, it's a good movie. It's really sweet, and it's kind of like... I want to be careful because it's nowhere near the levels of messed up-ness. But it's kind of like Crumb in a way, where these are two creative people from the same family, and one's found a much easier, in his own way, easier than Crumb, no matter what, but found an easier way to apply his passions in the world than the other. You know, Tom is a very sweet, low ambition guy who's never quite gotten it together, whereas Matt is highly successful, and it involves him following him around, and it's kind of getting in the way of it. And in the end, it becomes about, like Timothy says, it becomes about their relationship and them kind of getting it together. And you know, in a way, the actual completion of the film is the end of Tom's arc. He actually has made something worthwhile. And it's a good movie. Like I said, we kind of froze in the moment, but someone else pointed us toward, there's a publication called the AV Club. Are you familiar with it?
I've heard of it.
They did a list, which they call an inventory, about
I think I read a good book with that title once.
Yeah. Nice job picking out a lot of movies that began as one thing, another, including Errol Morris's Vernon, Florida, which became about this town in Florida, which had the highest rate of insurance fraud in the country, or some other sort of not so glorious claim to fame. And it basically just kind of changed into Morris sitting around talking to lots of different Floridians about their life. And it's a wonderful movie, not the movie he set out to make. And there are other examples as well.
Yeah. The name of that inventory is called Change of Plan, 15 Documentaries That Switched Course During Filming. It's from 2014. so after our tenure at the AV Club, but they put together a really good list, including some things that our listeners suggested to us that I think we all kind of collectively slapped our heads for not thinking of, like Capturing the Freedmans and Gimme Shelter.
And Lost in La Mancha, which if I'd been there, I think would have been my big suggestion. The film made by a couple of documentarians that thought they were going to do a behind the scenes, how did it get made, on Terry Gilliam's The Man Who Killed Don Quixote, and instead ended up with a documentary about how he didn't make that film because everything fell apart on roughly day two. I mean, it's a great documentary, but you can almost feel Terry Gilliam's horror at that, having cameramen there documenting the collapse of his film project. But it ends up being a really fascinating story.
But he's really making it now, Tasha.
Uh-huh.
He's really making it now.
Where are those documentarians, and are they standing next to him right now looking over his shoulder?
So we got another example from a different listener. Tasha, do you want to share that letter?
Yeah, absolutely. Taylor writes, "You were soliciting listeners for great examples of documentaries that start off as one thing and the story develops into something completely different. The one I was thinking of all through Wiener and immediately thought of as a great Next Picture Show pairing was The Queen of Versailles. In addition to the filmmaker going into a story initially to find one thing and having it be completely derailed by the hubris of the husband/father, both films strike the same balance of cringiness and tragedy as we watch as a family's life and a couple's marriage crumble around them, with the subjects never thinking to shoo the camera people away at their darkest moments."
Man, this was the example when it came in where I just like banged my head on the desk for not thinking of, because I love Queen of Versailles and it's such a good example of this phenomenon. And Taylor's right, it would be kind of a really good pairing with Wiener as far as the theme of hubris and self-awareness or lack thereof. So
it's hard to think of anything in the moment, Scott. So it's, you're out there listening, you think it's easy, but it's not.
It's like being on Wheel of Fortune. That Pat Sajak is just staring you down, man.
Sure.
But yeah, Queen of Versailles is a really good example. And it's also a really good pairing with Wiener, just in the sense that both of them have that kind of, I feel bad for them, but I don't feel bad for them,
right,
but I sympathize with them, but they brought this on themselves. It's like this really complicated circle of fault and sympathy and complete lack of sympathy. And this is cinematic comeuppance. Oh, but they're real people. And both of those films made me wonder how many half-made documentaries are out there where the subjects got to that turning point and then were just like, go away, filmmakers, and they never got any more footage.
Well, as always, we appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 and send those. We like those. We don't get enough of them. Or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. We may feature your response on a future episode or post it on Facebook for discussion. And that's it for this episode of The Next Picture Show. In the second half, we'll bring in a very different sort of Batman movie. Or is it? The Lego Batman movie. Look for that later this week. Or better yet, subscribe to The Next Picture Show on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Follow us at facebook.com/nextpictureshow and follow us on Twitter at @nextpicturepod, so you'll always know when a new episode drops. Until then, we'll be lurking in our respective bat caves, hovering over our computers wearing turtlenecks.
Go, go, go with a smile.
Keep busting.
And drawing from a script by Sam Hamm and Warren Scarron, he and Keaton deliver.
Okay, that time you made it rhyme even more, and it was even funnier.
They're just names. All right.
Maybe you could swap it up. Maybe it could be Sam Scarron and Warren Hamm.
Were so simple. All right. And drawing from a script by Samuel Harry Nerman.
I mean, they sound like Batman, but like Batman villains to be. Like, yeah. Sam Hamm is actually the Incredible Pig Man, and Warren Scarron is like the Scarmeister.
All right. Nobody left.